And welcome to Missions Sunday. We have had an incredible month. We've got to hear from those that we are working with and partnering with to love near and far. We got to hear from a gentleman that I got to meet just a couple of weeks ago, Vinicio. He was great. We had Clyde here last week with Eastern European Ministry. They're doing great work there. We've heard from several of our different missions partners in communion, and as you saw today, with update videos and scriptures and prayers. Clyde last week said something at the very beginning that I feel like someone might have put him up to, where he said, "Don't worry, preacher's got a timer today." And I'm back this week just to remind you that that's not how we get down at LCOC. But I'm excited to jump into Mission Sunday with you this morning and an iconic passage that everybody may be familiar with. Let's just start off right in the text and read together, and then we're going to jump right into it before we take up our special contribution today. I'm in Mark chapter 6. I love Mark. Mark is very short and to the fact. I consider the Gospels almost kind of like ESPN programming. If you read Matthew, you're going to get like a play-by-play account. If you read Mark, you're just going to get the highlights like SportsCenter. If you read John, you might get a 30 for 30, and then you get a full-blown documentary when you get Luke later. And Mark is just going to give you the high bits. But here, he includes something in this passage that's very popular and well-known and shared in the other Gospels that I think is going to be of special note for us today. I'm going to begin in verse 30. It says, "The apostles returned to Jesus and told him all that they had done and taught. He had just sent them out two by two into the countryside, and they had prayed with many, they had preached repentance, they had healed many, they had cast out demons." They saw extreme success, but in the midst of that wild success, and what would have been really exciting for Jesus and his disciples and the people of the region, Herod has John the Baptist executed wrongfully, in one of the most repudiable ways that I can even imagine. And so they're on the heels of this extreme high and now this extreme low. They come back and they're telling Jesus all that has happened. And he says to them in verse 31, "Come away by yourselves to a desolate place and rest a while. For many were coming and going and they had no leisure even to eat. And they went away in a boat to a desolate place by themselves. And many saw them going and recognized them. And they ran there on foot from all the towns and got there ahead of them. And he went ashore and saw a great crowd, and he had compassion on them." Please keep that word pegged in your mind this morning, because they were like sheep without a shepherd. "And he began to teach them many things." And then from verses 35 and on, you'll remember as we continue to progress today that Jesus goes on to feed 5,000 men and maybe women and children besides from just five loaves and two fishes. The feeding of the 5,000, just as it's known to us, a famous passage. And I know what you're thinking. It's a picture-perfect scene. Jesus and the disciples are going to get some R&R. They're coming out of the towns and following Jesus to this beautiful mountainside prairie. There's a cool breeze. I could just like see some blankets laid out. The hillside is dotted with those red and white like handkerchief picnic blankets that you haven't seen since Yogi Bear back in the day. A butterfly comes by and a fawn pokes out of a thicket over there and Jesus pets it. And it's just, it's a perfect scene. Like Jesus is having a picnic with his disciples and everybody's there and everybody is going to get fed. It's the vintage Sunday school Jesus moment. You probably colored this scene on some old cartoon sheets or even with some felt figures. Some old people out there today, that's way back. And before you get mad at me, we had felt figures too, so I'll date myself a little bit. This is the perfect moment to make that coloring book page out of. But I want to focus the context for us a little bit this morning because there's much more going on here beneath the miracle, aside from the miracle in and of itself. In fact, I don't think the miracle actually makes sense outside of it just being something cool that Jesus did that would let us know that he is who he says he is, unless we know the context that runs a little bit deeper. The context of this picnic, textually, historically, paint actually a little bit of a different picture than what I ever imagined. Here are a few things that I want you to remember as we talk about what happens here as we go. Jesus is leaving towns and villages to find a desolate place for some R&R, some peace and quiet. You could say Jesus was finally fed up with I-35 and he's going to the hill country. He's getting out of Dodge. He's going somewhere where nobody can find him, just not Fredericksburg, because I hear that that's actually really, really crazy there. It maybe looks something like this. I don't know. John the Baptist has just been murdered by Herod, and there hasn't really been a time as politically volatile or incendiary for the Jews, especially those Jews who are in resistance to the occupation of Rome than there is now. And here's why this matters. Because historically, that hill country where Jesus was going with his disciples, those desolate places, away from the towns and villages of that region, that is where the hotbed of the resistance hold up. That's where the zealots were. That's where the revolutionaries were. That's where later a group called the Sicarii would be. That's where the freedom fighters would be concentrated and holding up. And we know a little bit about the Jewish zealots, those who would see the overthrow of Rome by violence and by military or political force. Two of them traveled with Jesus and were among the 12. And later, they would be the ones that would incite the riot and the revolt that would lead to the utter destruction of Jerusalem and the temple in AD 70. So that's where this takes place. The center of that movement is located there. People that were sympathetic to violent overthrow. And so they reach this desolate place, and yet there's this enormous gathering, a huge crowd in the middle of nowhere. Y'all know I'm from West Virginia. There's lots of middle of nowhere places. And I could tell you how weird it would be to just be driving down Route 50, a lesson in desolation. It's only 70 miles, but it feels like 700 miles. It's just hill turn, hill turn, hill turn, deer, and hopefully the deer's not in the side of your car. That's what that place is like. I know what it would be like if I just saw 5,000 people hanging out there in the middle of nowhere. For Texans, it's like going to Amarillo and not one desecrated Cadillac, just tumbleweed and dust, nothing. And you just got a crowd of people from the whole region hanging out right there. And this happens right after John has been killed. So, the real question that I might ask is that we look at verse 44 where it says 5,000 men were there, maybe as many as 15,000 to 20,000 people if you count women and children. Why is it that all these people showed up in the first place to a desolate place? Why were they there? Why were they coming out? It's in John's account that we get a fuller picture of why they're actually there. And it's a realization that Jesus makes when he sees them. It's just percolating beneath the surface here in Mark. In John chapter 6, verse 15, it says, Jesus perceived that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king. Now you get a fuller picture of why these people are out in the wilderness. John has been killed, Jesus comes out, and this entire crowd shows up because they wanted a revolution. They were just waiting for the time, they were waiting for the sign, they were waiting for the chance to throw down and take over the crown. This happens right after the execution of John the Baptist, and frankly, family, you can't find a more sickening example of an oppressive government and regime that was unjust, that would cause people to reach this sort of a fever pitch. No wonder they are there to see what this Jesus was going to be. The one who John said was coming after him, who his sandals he wasn't worthy to loosen. The one that John said, he must increase and I must decrease. This wasn't a picnic, contrary to the Sunday school coloring books. This, to the people that showed up, was a revolution. And so in verse 34, Jesus does something incredible. And Jesus sees all of this, and it says in verse 34, he went ashore, he saw the great crowd, and he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. And the end of that verse says, he began to teach them many things. Jesus sees all of this, and he knows why they're there. It says he had compassion on them, for they were like sheep without a shepherd. And before I even say those words, I slip right back into that scenic picture that I painted for you with blankets, and the Lord is my shepherd comes into my mind in Psalm 23, and I think about cute little fuzzy lambs and just chewing some grass and getting pets from the shep. And it's another a picture of a storybook image again, but that's not what Jesus is saying here when he uses this phrase. Jesus is channeling something different. It actually goes all the way back to Moses. You see, in Numbers chapter 27, Moses is actually at the end of his life. He's not going to go into the promised land, but the children of Israel are. And he actually says this to God. It says in Numbers 27:15, "May the Lord God who gives breath to all living things appoint someone over this community to go out and come in before them, who will lead them out and bring them in, so the Lord's people will not be like sheep without a shepherd." That's where that phrase comes from. Moses is praying to God that he would appoint a political and military leader to succeed him. And God says after that, "Go and get Joshua." But this is common in the Old Testament, the concept of sheep and shepherds, referring to the relationship between political or military leaders and the people that they govern or that they care for. So when Jesus is in this desolate place and he knows that John is dead and he knows where he is regionally and geopolitically, and he says, "They are like sheep without a shepherd," he knows why they are there. They want a revolutionary leader. They want the next Moses to get Rome off of them. They want the next David. They want the next leader, the next Joshua, to lead them on a conquest. Knowing this, what Jesus does in 34 is so wild. His response is to teach them many things. Jesus, the radical revolutionary that he was, his response to the fever pitch spirit of political and military revolution was to teach the gospel. Isn't that crazy? I think we need to think about that today. I think we need to let that sink down into our hearts today, family. I think we need this so bad. Because do you know what you get from revolutionary leaders who people come to and say, "We want you to lead us, we want you to take over"? Do you know what you get from people like that? Do you know what usually happens? Do you know what the expectation is? Do you know how things are happening right now? Now, this happens in the Middle East of all places. This intractable conflict in Gaza right now is just the latest example. When masses come to revolutionary leaders and they ask for a new king, a new government, a revolution, they give them weapons. They came looking for swords. They came looking for orders. They come looking for rockets. They come looking for explosives. They come looking for the means of war, and it's happening in front of our very eyes at this moment, presently. And this is Jesus' response to the zealot. Not weapons, but bread and the bread of life. Jesus hears the cries for revolution, and he prescribes compassion and carbs. Jesus gave them the word. He gave them the bread. In this moment, he is refusing to engage in the model of revolution and how you get things done of the time. He will give them a revolution. Oh, he will. Just not the one they think they need. And not the one that they want. This is necessary for us to pause. Because there's guerrilla warfare happening right now. There are revolutions happening right now. There are weapons being dispensed across the globe to the tune of billions and billions of dollars right now. The way the world likes to solve problems has not changed in 2,000 years. The war machine still drones on day after day, fire after fire, conflict after conflict. It's important for us to ask. These disciples that were following Jesus, what did they think this occasion was? What type of revolution were they expecting? We know we had a couple of zealots in the mix, an ear cutter. It's also important for us to ask ourselves, what does Jesus' rejection of this world style of revolution communicate to us today? And I'm not going to spend too long here, but I just want to remind you that in the coming months, there's going to be a rising pressure on you, family. Every time you open your phone, you're going to hear it. Every time you open up your laptop or your tablet, you're going to see it. If you still listen to a radio, you're going to hear it. When you pick up a newspaper or a tablet, you're going to see it. When you turn on the TV, you will see it. When you sit at the Thanksgiving table in a couple of weeks across from someone that you talk to once a year and have to pretend to like, and they start going on a political rant, you're going to feel it right here. And I'm going to be there on Sunday, and we're going to give an invitation. Y'all can come and let all that bitterness out. And you can walk off some of that stuffing as you come down the aisle. Listen. The cry and the response to everything that is happening in the world right now is going to be the same that it has always been. We want a political revolution. We want a military revolution. We need someone to carry on the fight. We need to take up weapons if necessary. We need a strong leader who can do what needs to be done, because who can make heads or tails of the world anymore? But I wonder if what the church might need to do and be in this climate and in response to all of this is exactly what Jesus did on this day, on a desolate hillside, when the cries for revolution were just as loud, but a political and military leader of revolution was not what Jesus was going to be, because he knew that in those things, his people would not get what they actually needed. No, Jesus would not be coerced into fighting fire with fire. Family, I would submit to you this morning that it is our call to not be coerced into fighting fire with fire. Do not buy into the endless enterprise. Remember that just because Jesus did not fight in this way does not mean that he did not fight. And how he fought is how we can fight. And we need a Jesus-styled revolution. Whew, okay. That's the weirdest Mission Sunday sermon I ever started in my life. But verses 35 through 43 are so incredible. I want you to see how beautifully Jesus pulls this together and why it's the right thing we need today. Read with me what happens in verse 35. It says, "And when it grew late, his disciples came to him and said, 'This is a desolate place, and the hour is now late. Send these people away to go into the surrounding countryside and villages to buy themselves something to eat.' But he answered them, 'You give them something to eat.'" Some translations will say, "You feed them." Some of them say, "You yourselves feed them." And they said to him, "Shall we go and buy 200 denarii worth of bread and give it to them to eat? Should we go give half a year's wages to feed all these people here, Jesus? This is crazy. What are you saying?" And he said, "How many loaves do you have? Go and see." And when they found out, they said, 5 loaves and 2 fishes. And then he commanded them all to sit down in groups on the green grass. Jesus is about to perform a miracle. But I want you to think about how he performs this miracle and why he performs this miracle. Because Jesus does not do miracles the way that I would do miracles. And I suspect that I'm not alone in this. I suspect that we all would probably do miracles for the same reason that we would expect Jesus to do miracles. Just as we read how this is done, I want you to think about why and how. It said, "They sat down in groups by hundreds and fifties, and taking the 5 loaves and 2 fish, he looked up to heaven and said a blessing and broke the loaves and gave them to the disciples to set before the people. And he divided the 2 fish among them all. And they all ate and were satisfied and took up 12 baskets full of broken pieces of fish. And those who ate the loaves were 5,000 men." When I think of doing a miracle, I am always tempted to think the purpose behind the miracle, the reason to do the miracle, would be so that people knew exactly who it was they were dealing with, to prove that I am the Son of God, or that I should be in charge here, or you should follow me. That's how I would do miracles. I would do miracles if I was Jesus so that people would know who they were dealing with, and my miracles would be a flex. They would be a show of power so that people would follow me. And that makes sense. It's logical. But look at the context. There's already a ton of people following Jesus, and they're ready. They're ready for him to say the word they would fight right now. And even so, bread, that's the miracle. I know I've got about 16 minutes before there's hangry ladies in here who need carbs, and the bread will be a great miracle for them. But this is the Son of God. This is what we're doing? But bread? Healing some blind people? But making some wine so the party can go on for a couple more days? Like, no, we need lightning to fall on the Roman garrison. No, we need a Thanos snap. If we could just boom, Rome is gone. Like, that's the Son of God. Like, some of you guys are thinking, yeah, we could just get rid of a whole political party like that. I'm not going to say which one, but you need to repent about that. Jesus doesn't do miracles that way. That's not how he operates. Jesus doesn't do miracles as a show of power. He doesn't do spectacle. He's never doing it as a flex. It's not that kind of revolution, family. I often think we mistake Jesus' miracles as something that he did that suspended the natural order in order to make a point. But I have been convicted that that's really a backward way of looking at the miracles of Jesus. They don't suspend the natural order. Only a person who doesn't know God could think about this and assume that he would do miracles that suspended the natural order. Just hang with me for a few seconds, family. Okay, look, if Jesus is God, and he was with God and was God at the beginning, and the world was created through him, and if the New Testament is correct, that it exists and continues to be at the word of his power, that in him all things are held up and held together, and if when that world was created, God said it was good, and in those good days, there was no sickness, no infirmity, no hunger, no injustice, no violence, and that's how the world was created to be in its natural state. That was its design. If that was Eden, and if Jesus says in the new heavens and new earth, that's how it's going to be again. No pain, no poverty, no sickness, no hunger, no murder. Then the miracles of Jesus are not a suspension of the natural order. They're a restoration of the natural order. They are how it was supposed. It's Jesus putting things right as they should be, as God wants them, as Jesus wants them, and as each and every one of us actually long for them to be. They show that Jesus is not any more happy about the way things are in the world than we are. Jesus' miracles are not a breaking of the natural order. They are echoes of Eden, and they are whispers of the new heavens and the new earth. They are the only truly natural thing in a fallen and broken world, overrun. Family, do not settle for a worldview in which these broken things, war, pestilence, hunger, sickness, injustice, are inevitable and the natural state of things. If you know that God didn't make the world this way, and he's not going to let it stay this way, it will give you the bread that you need to have hope in these desperate times. It will give you the bread you need to have joy. It will give you the bread that you need to walk in faith. It will give you the bread you need to reject the fear and the angst and the uproar of the world's call for violent revolution. And it will give you what you need to be a part of Jesus's instead. Hope about the future is bread for your soul right now. Pause. What do you truly believe about the future? What do you truly hope about the future? We humans are irrevocably hope-based creatures. What we believe about the future will change everything about how we feel in the present, how we think, how we walk, how we move, how we feel. So, here we are, the restoration of the natural order, Jesus inviting people into a different revolution. Jesus essentially saying to the crowds and to his disciples, if you have this bread, you will be a part of my revolution, and you will be sent into my mission of undoing poverty and injustice and hunger and sickness and violence. And look at how he does this miracle. We all read it. I want to read it again because I read it a million times and I never saw it. I never got it, but it hits like a truck. Look, 35 through 42, one more time. Here's what he says. He says that he had them sit down in groups and taking the 5 loaves and 2 fish, he looked up to heaven. He said a blessing and broke the loaves and gave them to the disciples. One more time. He said a blessing and broke the loaves and gave them to the disciples to set before the people. Track with me, church. And gave them to the disciples to set before the people and gave them to the disciples to set before the people. Look, the disciples come with an absolutely logical and reasonable suggestion. Jesus, send these people out to get food. And Jesus' response is to make a completely illogical, unreasonable demand of disciples who are unqualified to fulfill it. He just says, you give them some food. You feed them. And they respond with a lot of sarcasm. It's impossible. What you're asking us to do is impossible. There are 5 loaves. There are 2 fish. There's not enough supply for all these people. And Jesus looks at them and he says, exactly. Exactly. Jesus says, until you see that what I'm actually calling you to do is impossible, you're unqualified to fulfill it. Look, this is why Jesus doesn't just Gandalf this miracle. So if I was Jesus, I would Gandalf the miracle. I would like show up and I would just be like, hey guys, I'm Jesus. My provision is neither late nor early. It arrives precisely when I mean for it to. You shall not fast. And there would be bread everywhere. Fish falling from the sky. I did bring this up here just to do that. Thank you for... Thank you. Thank you so much. But Jesus doesn't do that. He doesn't just magically constitute carbohydrates on the hillside. He doesn't just... Wingardium Leviosa, some bread out there. There, I threw you one, Potterhead. You like that? Leviosa. This is why no one likes it. Jesus doesn't do it the way we do it. We can't even not argue about it right now. We're joking around. But here's how he does it. He simply uses the food that they've already got. No spectacle. He just uses their food, even though it's inadequate for the job. And here's the thing that rocked my world on this. It's only as the disciples go out and start distributing that inadequate food that it gets multiplied. Don't miss this. It's only as the disciples go out to people that Jesus meets the need through the disciples. You see, family, Jesus knows that the work he is calling us to do in our eyes, by our count, is impossible. He knows the supply is not enough. But what is an insufficient supply when you are the living creator of the universe and the ultimate supplier? You see, the disciples got caught up in the size of the moment. They became so worried about the lack of supply that was available to them that they forgot they were walking with the supplier. Can you imagine? And before I'm critical of them, how often do I do that every single day? I can say in one breath, I have nothing that God has not given me, and then the next breath say, I don't know how I'm gonna make it. Ain't people funny? Jesus knows that asking you to go into a world and tell people about him in a relevant, non-weird, non-creepy Christian way sounds impossible because you don't think you have the words that are the supply that you need. Jesus knows that the brokenness in the community around us is so severe that it will take a literal miracle to fix it. Jesus knows that it'll take a miracle to heal the relationship that you gave up on a long time ago. Jesus knows it's going to take a miracle to feed 250 families a week here at this church on a budget of $200 a month. And yet somehow every week there's $25,000 going into the community. Jesus knows that by our count, it doesn't make any sense. But that's how Jesus does revolutions. Through unqualified, undersupplied disciples who go out and meet the needs of people with what they have, no matter how small, and that's how he does it. He likes to do it through us. I can't explain why, and most of the time I can't explain how, but that's how our God likes to get down. When those who know they are inadequate, out of obedience, go and do it anyway, that's when Jesus supplies. And that's when he multiplies. Five loaves and two fish, family. Five loaves, two fish, and a revolution. Welcome to Mission Sunday. The shepherds have put forward a bold goal this year. If you've seen one of these, you've seen all of the different places that we give and that this church is involved in the missions that we support and that we partner with. And they put forward a bold goal to raise $56,000 in one Sunday for the missions this congregation has partnered with. And that might look like a big number to you. You might be like Philip, who in the Gospels came to Jesus and was like, bro, that's half a year's wages. And for some of us, that's more than half a year's wages in one day. I want you to remember that these five loaves and two fish, I want you to remember what God has done here in this place with seemingly small and insignificant supplies. And I want you to thoughtfully consider just bringing your five loaves and two fish and setting them at the feet of Jesus today for this offering. The only thing that Jesus asks us to do is bring what we have. You might feel like you are unqualified. You might feel like this church is unqualified. Oh, I got a newsflash for you. We always have been. You might feel like there isn't enough to go around from your personal supply. Please don't forget that you walk with the supplier. And when you give what you have to the supplier, he becomes the multiplier. And Jesus sent his disciples into the crowd undersupplied and met the needs of everyone there with baskets to spare. And every Sunday when you give, and every time you volunteer your time, and today when you give with intention and purpose, he sends those five loaves and two fish to heal the broken, feed the hungry, bring hope to the oppressed. He's going to always supply if you're willing to go. And he's always willing to multiply if you are willing to give. That is his revolution. And we're all invited. So given what we read here today and what we know about this Jesus that we follow, I think this number, this $56,000 the shepherds have appointed, is actually pretty conservative. I know the hearts here are generous, so I'm only asking that you would consider what you will give to these missions, to this mission, to this revolution, if you will, that you just continue to be who you've always been. But today, add the courage to see an inadequate supply multiply in the hands of Jesus.